In the days of Jesus Christ, the most feared soldiers on the face of the earth were those of the legions of Rome. These men were viewed by their neighbors as practically invincible. And it seemed that no nation of that day could stand against these men of war. One of the many reasons why they were so powerful and so feared was because their armies were led by men called centurions. These centurions were seasoned veterans and were commanders of units of approximately 100 men each. In today's armies, they would be roughly the equivalent of a major, captain, or a major. They were masters of the martial arts of the time. They were the Navy SEALs, the Army Rangers, the Green Berets of their day. They were typically utilized for special assignments, in addition to leading men in a time of war. And they were expected to have cool heads under heavy pressure or under heavy fire. They were expected to be in the front lines. They never retreated. They always held their ground. The standards for being a centurion were very high, and people had to work hard, and they had to have a Spartan life to do it. In fact, you couldn't have a family and be a centurion. Not really. You were, in a sense, celibate for 20 years at least as you dedicated yourself to Rome. Much was required from the typical soldier, but from his centurion, it was very, very much so that way. They were given special assignments, as I mentioned. If you read in the book of Acts, and the Bible talks at least about as many as four centurions, but there would be times where they would escort the Apostle Paul. He himself, claiming Roman citizenship, needed protection. And there was a centurion that was assigned by the monarchy to be able to make sure that Paul had safe passage to Caesarea, another fortress that was owned or built and occupied by the Roman army. There were other times when the centurions were called upon in Jerusalem to keep the peace, and you couldn't have just anybody in that role. Realize that unlike any other country in the Roman Empire, the Jews had this migration on the holy days. Three times a year, they would either come in the spring or maybe during the time of Pentecost, and we acknowledged that holy day last week, or in the fall with the Feast of Tabernacles, and they would converge for religious worship. But the Romans feared that, if they all get together, and we have an influx here in Jerusalem of maybe 40,000 Jews from around the empire, they call that the diaspora, and they converge, why, they could foment a revolution. They could have a riot. They would outnumber us. And so over time, the Romans built what was called the fortress of Antonia that was right next to the temple, where thousands of Romans, at the drop of a hat, could be mustered to hurry over to quell any riots. And there were. I'll talk more about that later. But they had very important and significant assignments. They were the ones that held the army together. Greek historian Polybius made the comment, quote, in choosing their centurions, the Romans did not, you had to have, be successful and be in outstanding health and have great reflexes and be well-versed in martial arts. But in choosing their centurions, the Romans looked for more than just daring type of men. They wanted men that were natural leaders that possessed a stable mind under pressure. Men who would open, not men that would open a battle and launch attacks or pick fights and just to live by their heart rather than their heads, but those who would stand their ground even when hard pressed and even die in defense of their posts. They had to be psychologists. They had to understand group behavior as well as individual behavior. Very, very important. They were the most dependable and the most level-headed people in the Roman army. Those that were above them, that were called tribunes, usually were politically appointed. They didn't really have the practical ground experience. As far as practical experience, the centurions were the most capable in the entire Roman army. And they were very dependable. They had the respect of most people. And back in that time, Rome was the only nation that crucified anyone. And they did it often. As one scholar noted, quote, "Romans practiced both random and intentional violence against populations that they had conquered, killing tens of thousands by crucifixion," which is squeamish. And they were not the jobs for ordinary soldiers. Centurions were used in this regard, and men worked underneath them. Centurions had to stand watch at night and hear the moans and the cries of the crucified. And they watched in the daylight to see men slowly, painfully die on their crosses. I think we can understand that in Jesus' day, that there were certain people that were despised, like tax collectors or Samaritans, certain Gentiles. That was not the mind of God, but in their self-righteousness, a number of the Jewish aristocracy ended up thinking that way. And one of the groups that was disdained because of the Roman occupation was soldiers of Rome. But not all centurions were despised, as we'll see. You would think that they would be at the top of the list. But they were more well-rounded and special in a way, and we will look at some of the unusual traits that they had. The most significant trait that I'd like to discuss that these military men had that drew high praise from God. Can you imagine that? Men of war. What is it that they would have done that would have also drawn praise from Jesus Christ or from God himself? They were well-versed and grew up in a military culture. But the amazing thing was that when, as deeply as they understood authority, they were under authority, then when they decreed something, it was done. So as what Yul Brynner said, "So I've decreed it, so it shall be done." And it was. If you gave an order in the army, it's still the same now to some extent, but back then, as the quote goes, they took no prisoners. If the emperor ordered something, it was carried out. If a centurion did, it was carried out. All he had to do was give the order, and he knew that it would be carried out because he knew that the people that received the order knew that they would be put to death if they didn't carry it out. And so that was significant. I'd like for us to go now to Matthew chapter 8 and read an account that probably we're familiar with, but maybe the detail that we'll look at will surprise us. In Matthew chapter 8, we're going to look at one centurion who is extraordinary. This is Matthew chapter 8, and we'll begin in the first verse. It says, "When Christ was come down from the mountain, where he gave what was sometimes referred to as the Sermon on the Mount, great multitudes followed him." Verse 2, "And there came a leper and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, if you would, can you make me clean?' And Jesus put forth his hand and touched him, saying, 'I will that you be clean.' And immediately his leprosy was cleansed." And Jesus, and understandably, that got the attention of a lot of people. People that live with no hope now suddenly realize, well, if I can get to the Son of God, this man, Jesus, maybe he can heal me. And that would happen. And so the throngs of people were following Christ. Verse 4, "And Jesus said to him, 'See that you tell no man, but go your way, show yourself to the priest and offer a gift to Moses,'" that was following Israelite law from back in the book of Leviticus and Exodus. So after that, verse 5, Christ is still on the move. He came to his hometown of Capernaum, and there a centurion was beseeching him. This was so unusual that a centurion would be going to a Jew to say, "Can you help me?" Because centurions were self-sufficient. They were tough. They endured all kinds of rigorous activity. In times of war, even in times of peace, they had to be stoic, Spartan, persevering, independent. And this particular centurion came to Christ, beseeching him, saying, "Lord, my servant lies at home, sick of palsy, grievously tormented, maybe going into spasm, maybe just inches away from or a few minutes away from death." There was a sense of urgency here. Now, something that's easy to gloss over is the centurion said, I'll get to that later. But we'll see from Luke chapter 7 that this particular servant was a special friend, somebody that this centurion cared for. I might as well point it out now. Life was cheap back in those days. Slave labor, abundant and cheap. And people were exploited so often. And many people that were in authority just used the slaves underneath them. And this centurion was very, very fond, we'll find out, of this particular servant. And having no family of his own, probably, he was very close to this person. It was more than just a slave, you know. We'll get rid of him, we'll get another. Keep on going. Wasn't like that. So the centurion had passion. Now, it was never out of control. He obeyed rules. He served at the pleasure of Rome. But he still had room in his heart for people. He was not impervious to the needs and the cares and the sicknesses of others. So he's pleading with Christ. And Jesus said, "Well, I will come and I will heal him." And the centurion said something that shocked even Jesus Christ. He said, "Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof." Most people, even in Israelite society, but in Gentile society, in all society, the further up the rung of ladder they are, the more important they are. That's right. I'm the big moose around here. Yeah, I'm number one or number five, whatever. Yeah, the world revolves around me. It doesn't. Kind of like the example of the ant that was on this log going down a river, and he's got his knees up. He's on his back, and so the knees are blocking out some of the sunlight. And he's coming under the drawbridge. Here he is on the river, and the drawbridge is 20 feet above him. But because of his knees, it blocks out the his view of the bridge. And so he yells up to the man at the controls, "Open up the drawbridge, I'm coming through." And he's microscopic, nobody knows it's the sand's even talking. So it's amazing how people gravitate towards self-importance. And anybody like a centurion who really was high up in the chain of authority that had, quote-unquote, paid his dues, been around, served at the pleasure of the emperor, and had been elevated over time to higher and higher authority and positions, well, you wouldn't expect somebody like that to come and say, "Look, I'm not worthy to be even in your presence." And Christ wasn't asking him to be so self-effacive. But by comparison, apparently this centurion had noticed what Christ had been doing and realized something that the other Jews tried not to acknowledge, that he had the ability to heal. He was the Son of God. And he represented a greater, higher authority than the authority of Rome. It's one thing to say, "Yes, sir, emperor." It's another thing to say, "Yes, sir, God." God is supreme. And mankind has been fighting that ever since. Invented systems of belief to contradict the idea that God is supreme. Well, maybe God doesn't exist. Evolution shows that. Or let's create a God in our image. They'll give us permission to do what we want to do. That's what the Greeks and the Romans did, and others in mythology. If I get drunk all the time, we'll create a God, Bacchus, God of wine. Well, you know, he gets drunk once in a while too. So, you know, that's why, you know, I relate to them, him. Or I relate to Eros or Athena or Zeus or... there's just a whole slew of false gods that mankind has made that he tried to replace the true God with. At any rate, this servant acknowledged the supremacy of Christ and the government that Christ represented. Now, that takes God's spirit to be able to do that. But he was able to acknowledge that. And it came at Capernaum, we'll go to Matthew 13 in a little bit, where Christ ended up saying, you know, a prophet, like he was, is not without honor except in his own house, in his own country. Familiarity sometimes breeds contempt. Doesn't have to. But Christ didn't do many great works in Capernaum because of their unbelief. They thought, hey, this guy's in the, you know, this is a carpenter. What's he got to do with religion? Hey, we've known him ever since he was a child. He was very good. He was very respectful. I never saw him getting in any trouble. You know, he never broke any windows throwing rocks like the other kids in the neighborhood. Didn't steal a thing. Just a perfect angel. But, I mean, he was a kid. Not the son of God. Come on. People didn't, they just couldn't wrap their minds around that for a long time. That this person was divine. And certainly those that put him to death rejected that concept. But this centurion saw that he represented a kingdom of God. And he says, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof, but speak the word only. This is what a military man would say, and my servant shall be healed. Many times it's natural for us to think, well, I need to be healed. I've been praying about this. I sure hope it happens. Will it happen? I think so. Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief, you know. And the centurion said, you don't even have to come. Just give the word. And then he said, I'm a military man. Have been all my life. If I tell somebody to do something, they do it. I know they're going to do it. I don't even have to. Did you do it? Let me check on you. Because it's chop, chop if he doesn't. And if I'm given a command, I do it. I have to do it. The emperor knows that I'll do it. I will do it or I'll die trying because I'm required to do that. It's very different. So the centurion says, I'm under authority just like, and I follow the directives given to me. So if you say that my servant will be healed, I trust your authority. Your word is good enough. Your word is gold. And and when we read through the story in the detail, maybe it's more in Luke, it wasn't that the Christ was miles and miles away from this servant that was near death. He was very, very close. He could have easily walked all the way. You know, walk the extra 100 and 200 yards and say, I'm here. Let's, you know, I'm already here. Let's go in and do that. You know, I out of respect to you, I'm happy to come in person. But the centurion said, you don't even need to do that. Your time, you can be spent maybe somewhere else, but just give the word and that's good enough for me. I know it will happen. That could only be if Christ the servant acknowledged the supremacy of God. And when Jesus heard it, verse 10, he marveled. He said, verily I say to you, I've not found such great faith, no, not in all of Israel. And he's saying that Capernaum was basically an Israelite city. And he was implying to any of the eavesdroppers around that were listening, he gives us more respect. And he is not, he wasn't brought up in maybe to understand some of the things that we do. But he clearly sees the chain of authority in God's church. or in God's way of life. So that was something that impressed Christ so much. And the word, when he marvel in the Greek, it's interesting that that's only used one other time. And I think that's in Mark 6, where Christ is marveling at the unbelief of his kinsmen, that they could be so close and so far, so close to the truth, so close to Jesus Christ, and still not know who he was. And so we go over to Luke chapter 7 and add to what we've already seen. You'll find in the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that one writer will cover some material and others will emphasize different other concepts, and you can blend them together to get the comprehensive picture. And over in Luke chapter 7, let's see. We'll find out some other amazing material, at least amazing to me. Verse 1 of chapter 7. Now, when he had ended all his sayings, in the audience of the people, he entered into Capernaum. We've seen that. And a certain centurion's heart, who was dear unto him, was sick and ready to die. Other officers might have said, well, I can kick this guy to the curb. I don't need him. If he dies, there's 20 other people I can choose to take his place. No, it was very personal, the relationship. And he asked for Christ. We already saw that. And another thing in verse 5, or verse 4, Jews came to Christ and besought him instantly, saying, this was that he was worthy for whom he should do this. In other words, there were a group of Jews, they were influential in Capernaum, that wanted Christ to heal the centurion's servant. And they were saying to Christ, it wasn't the centurion directly asked. That shows additional humility. He sent a group of people, an impressive group, you know, some of his best men, to Christ. Hey, can you heal my daughter? But he didn't even go himself. It's like, I'm not worthy to even show my face. And that was not required of God. But the other Jews said, please help him. Most Jews would not do that for centurions and others. Their attitude was, these Romans don't belong here. They've taken away our freedom. They threaten our religion. They tax us. They take our olive oil and other products and think they're entitled to it. Think they're entitled because their pagan gods gave them the permission to come over here and take control of us. We don't like them. Of course, we don't like Gentiles either. And we don't like people that don't kiss up to the Sanhedrin, the Jewish aristocracy. And we hate these people. There was a riot, a revolution or a riot in Judea approximately every 6 years when the Romans occupied it. And some of the revolts were quite serious. And you read about some of the leaders that tried to revolt in the book of Acts chapter 5. We won't go into that. But that's the way they felt for all the Roman army. They were invaders. And many of the centurions, but not all. In this case, they are doing the bidding of the centurion. And why? Verse 5. For this centurion loves our nation, and he's built us a synagogue. What? Since when do Roman soldiers build synagogues for the Jews? In an era, in a land where they're not welcome and they're not liked. It doesn't make sense. But when you consider the demands on the Roman centurions, you know, they had to be master psychologists. They had to have cool heads when other people were angry and upset. They had to pick their battles. They had to perform special duties and be trusted to always do it correctly. They were well paid. If the average soldier made $15,000 a year in today's money, the centurions were paid at least 20 times that. So they would be pulling in $300,000 or more. If they were a supervisor, then they might even have, it might be even five times higher than that. And then there would be one centurion in charge of everybody, and he was paid $1 million a year. Their service was recognized, their value. And probably some of the very best centurions. And in Judea, you would have an area that would require about 25, maybe 30 for the amount of population. But one of the reasons why it was so important to have the right people in the right slots in the chain of authority, Judea was considered one of the treasures of the Roman Empire. They did have a lot of natural resources. They had a wonderful climate. It was an honor to be assigned the plum job, say Pontius Pilate, of being in Jerusalem. Comfortable climate and access to a lot of natural resources and foods. And unlike today, in the time of the Romans, there were forests. It was a verdant, plush place. A lot of it's desert now. But it wasn't that way originally. And in the millennium, when Christ returns, it'll be retransformed back to the way it used to be. So it was a plum assignment to be stationed there. And it was an area that was considered very, very rich. A wonderful addition to the Roman Empire. However, Rome thought long and hard before taking over that area. They said, yeah, we can use the natural resources. It's a strategic land bridge between three continents, basically. It's something that we really could use and benefit from. But the drawbacks are that the people are unruly, and they will be demanding, and they are fierce for their God. And we can't. We've really got to think this through before we try to occupy. And even then, under Pontius Pilate, he made a few mistakes and created mass riots in the city. And at one point in 70 AD, the Romans decided they had to invade the city and quell the uprisings. But this was ongoing. It was a smoldering hotbed of violence. And there was the Maccabean revolt. Prior to 165 BC, prior to Christ, a lot of different tensions existed here. So they had to have above average management. They had to have their best men, maybe best salaried people, in control of Jerusalem, in control of the army at Antonia, that big fortress, to be absolutely sure. So they decided to go ahead and annex Judea. And they thought, well, in order to annex, we're going to have to make it palatable to the Jews. So unlike in the rest of the Roman Empire, in Judea, we will not draft people into the Roman army. Also, they will be able to have their religion. We'll leave them alone. They can have their temple. They can have a local treasury that we will not take over. And so they made different concessions, but still it was uneasy. And so it would be a wise selection, or wise to promote, at least in the eyes of the Roman leadership, take people that are reliable military people, that are moving their way up the ranks, and if they're also very intelligent and very socially connected to people and understand trends, that we could allow some that have even converted to Judaism to also become centurions. And this, so I'm suggesting, even that it's not spelled out, that people, there were a couple of centurions that were also converts to the Jewish faith. They are called God-fearers. That's mentioned in the, especially in the book of Acts. What that means is they believed what the Jews believed, but they were not circumcised. And even as God-fearers, they did not have some of the full recognition, full rights of native Jews in that area. But what I'm leading up to is that it is entirely possible for somebody to have been, maybe unusual, but somebody to have been supportive of the Jewish faith and become a centurion and be a qualified, very capable centurion that was wealthy enough to be able to donate significant amounts of money to the construction of a synagogue. So he had high recognition among Jews as well as Gentiles. It's because of what we see in verse 5. He loved our nation and he has built us a synagogue. And Christ was going to heal him even if none of that was true. But again, this was an unusual man, quite unusual. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 53 through 58, I made reference to this. I'll read it. Matthew 13, and 53. When it came to pass, and when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed. And when he came to his own country, he taught them in their synagogue, insomuch that they were astonished and said, "Whence has this man this kind of wisdom and these mighty works? I mean, it doesn't add up. Isn't he the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary and his brothers, lists four of them, James, Joseph, Simon, Judas, and his sisters? So he had at least six siblings. Whence then has this man made all these things?" And they were offended in him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor save in his own country and in his own house." That is a quirk of human nature. Later on, the veils fell off their eyes and they were dumbfounded to realize that not only was he a son of man, he was divine. So now, I'd like to move on to yet another centurion, but I should go to Luke 2, verse 52 first. Luke 2, verse 52. This is a description of Jesus Christ, and hopefully it can be a description of us. And I, verse 52 of Luke 2, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Well, this was true of the centurion that we just read about that lived near Capernaum, which would be on the edge of the Sea of Galilee, to be in favor with God, in favor with the Jews, and in favor with Gentiles, at least having their respect. They might say, "I don't believe what you believe, but I do respect the fact that you are that convicted." Now, there was an unnamed centurion over in Matthew 27. Matthew 27. And to conserve some time, I will just describe a few incidents rather than to turn to all of these accounts. In Matthew 27, we can read the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And there was a centurion there in Matthew 27. Let's see, in at the time when Christ died, in verse 54, it says, "Now when the centurion and those that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake that occurred and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, 'Truly this was the Son of God.'" Here is a case, a different centurion probably than the one in Matthew 8 or Luke 7. This one, unnamed, was watching Christ die and then said, "This is truly the Son of God." Maybe he said that with fear and trembling. But here's another example of a man under authority that concluded at the end that he was looking at a person representing greater authority than that of Rome, because truly he says, "This was the Son of God." You know, somebody greater than the son of Zeus or the son of Jupiter, this son of God, and was amazed. So The reason there was a centurion there, somebody had to supervise the crucifixion. And that most men in the Roman Empire, I'm sorry, in the Roman army, according to some of the commentaries, it was stated that they just didn't have the stomach for it. I can't imagine I could do that, or any of you, to watch these horrible deaths and to be responsible, in a sense, assigned, and watch the nails get pounded into people, and knowing that when people are hoisted up, that when they come down, they'll be dead. Hear the moans and the cries through the nights and the days when death did not come quickly. So that was a job for a centurion. And many a soldier opted out unless that soldier was a centurion. So sometimes some were asked to do things that they perhaps would not want to do. But one of the things that amazed them was Christ's demeanor during the crucifixion. And it makes me think of Isaiah 9 in verse 2. A statement that applies to the people that have come in contact with Christ, that have understood his way of life, and the centurions who understood how unique life was, how precious it was. Isaiah 9 and verse 2, the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light, and they that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them has the light shined. There are multiple applications of this verse, but for those people that encountered Christ and saw him the way God, he really was, the Son of God, it had to make a very positive impression. And I won't say all the centurions, they were carnal human beings. It wasn't like they were, the majority of them were God-fearing. But as different ones came into contact with the government of God, whose representative was Jesus Christ, it was different. Wow, there's something to this. They might not have seen it right away, but eventually they saw it. Eventually, the man who was the centurion that was there at Christ's death saw that. It wasn't just, oh, I guess he was the Son of God after all, and just walks away. It's no, wow, there's something to this, something deep. Something deep that would make him give his life. Something deep that his backup, his God in heaven, allows the earthquakes, the veil to rip in half, and the temple, and other amazing things. Plus, there was a physical resurrection in the same chapters talked about where, I don't know if it was 50 or 100 or whatever people brought, came out of their graves, came back into Jerusalem. And they were saying, I'm here to say that I was dead and I'm alive now. And people in a panic, wow, what happened? This is why on the day of Pentecost, you had thousands of people that were on the edge of baptism. They were excited about this way of life, and they saw these miracles, and they remembered just a few days earlier Christ's death and the events that surrounded that. Let's move on to Acts 27. Acts 27, to show you how unique the centurion position was. I think we've all had times where we needed help with something. We call on the phone. Maybe it's with a computer. There's a glitch. You don't know what to do, so you call for technical support. Or maybe you have an issue with the bank, or I don't know, some procedural issue. And the answer is the person on the other end of the phone is basically saying, well, rules are rules. I can't help you. I can't answer that question. And ultimately, you appeal to a supervisor, somebody. Oftentimes, the higher you go up the chain of command, the more lenient the people are at the top than at the bottom to give you the answer that you need. Instead of saying, look, the answer is no. It's in the manual. It's on page 33. What's your problem? Well, my problem is that this isn't exactly the situation your manual describes. And so what else can be done? And, I had an experience with our just a few weeks ago. I had was moving one van in the driveway to And it didn't have, it, we thought that it had bad breaks. What I didn't know, it had none. It had gone from bad to impossible. And I backed into the other van, and it'll get covered by insurance. But our older van, they wanted to say that they couldn't insure it because it was totaled out. It was ridiculous. I said, you know how much I paid for this thing? You know, and it's got a special ramp, and it's got this, and it's got that, and that's expensive. And so the person, you know, first person says, I can't help you. And so I appealed to somebody else, and then, well, we'll have to get back with you in a couple days. And so a couple days go by, nobody's back with me, so I talk to somebody else that's higher up. And, well, we'll have to talk about it. And I was on hold for 20 minutes, and I'm thinking, well, the longer I'm on hold, the better this is going to work out. And so finally the answer was, oh, yes, we'll take care of it, you know. And and they wrote me a check for more than it was worth. And that wasn't the way it started out. Sometimes people at the top, they've got more authority, they have more latitude to bend or do things. And so that's what you have here in Acts 27. Paul was going to be sent from Caesarea to Rome. He had appealed to the Caesar, and so he was going to go to Caesar. Well, he was being delivered with other prisoners. It was a special project, and so they put a centurion in charge. Typically, centurions are not real chummy with the people that they're in charge of. It's like in the jail system. You don't see the guards, socializing at length with the inmates. And so there's a professional distance in so much of this. But to make a longer story short, when Julius, this is in verse 1, it says in, Acts 27, 1. And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustus band. And Julius probably had a professional distance, as he would do with his job, with everybody. But verse 3, and the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go unto his friends and to refresh himself. Paul was with other people, and he had permission to go see them. The centurion was able to do that. So they had to be diplomats. They had to know where the boundary lines were, but they were entrusted by the Roman authorities to be able to exercise certain latitude if they felt it would make things better. And since Paul was a Roman citizen, and viewed as being innocent by a number of people that sent him to Rome, this centurion warmed up to him and was very accommodating of his needs. And in exchange, Paul was reassuring to the centurion because they shipwrecked. And if any of the prisoners escaped in that storm, Rome would have said, who is in charge? That person will be executed. You do not let prisoners run away. Well, yeah, but it was a shipwreck. Well, yeah, but this is the law of Rome. So it was pretty serious. And Paul had said, do not worry. We're all here. Nobody's going anywhere. Another place is Acts chapter 10. You're probably familiar with Acts chapter 10 because this is a different centurion, Cornelius. Verse 1 of Acts 10, there was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the, not Augustus band, but the Italian band. That's not a rock group. That's a group of people that he was in charge of. A devout man. How can this centurion, Gentile, be devout to Judaism? That's what's indicated. And one who feared God with all his house, his whole family, which gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. Perhaps another wealthy person, just like the one in Matthew 8. It's not likely that they're the same people. because their contact with God's representatives are years apart. And he prayed to God always. Oh, that it could be said of us, as it said here, and also in verse 4 and in verse 31, that Cornelius' alms and prayers are a memorial before God. God was very impressed with him and decided to choose to convert him as the first Gentile and make it so obvious to Peter and to the others that God was working with the Gentile world, because they were speaking, Cornelius and his whole family eventually were converted, and they were able to speak in other languages as a stamp of God's approval or manifestation of God's spirit, and not gibberish, but other actual languages. So he was a devout man. So God saw in Cornelius somebody who is special, and he was even going to make him more special and utilize him even further. Well, this is highly unusual. And at one point, Cornelius is so in awe of God, the government of God, that he bows down before Peter, who reprimands and says, "Well, stand up, for I too am a man. You know, that's I don't require allegiance to me." And verse 30, Cornelius said, "Four days ago I was fasting until this hour. And at the ninth hour I prayed in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in bright clothing and said, 'Cornelius, your prayer is heard and your alms.'" This was a vision that he had in remembrance in the sight of God. And then in the vision, he was given instruction to meet with Peter, and who ended up laying hands on him in conversion. So that he was baptized in verse 48. But that was an amazing thing. He had faith. He saw God in the picture. He was a man under authority. And if a greater authority says, "This is going to happen, that's going to happen, or do this, do that," okay, where do I start? Where's the beginning line? I'll do it. This is an attitude of white-hot zeal that we don't see in our society today. Our society is laid back, perhaps lazy, unfocused. People don't know what they believe. They're very confused and not self-directed. They just aimless. And what a contrast to some sterling examples of people that God was able to utilize greatly. Let's take a look now in Acts chapter 16 of a man. He was not a centurion. Maybe he was working his way up through the ranks, and perhaps he might have been considered centurion material in the future. Acts chapter 16. Acts chapter 16. On one of Paul's journeys, he goes to different towns, Lystra, Iconium, and he's interfacing with new converts. And then, let's see, he goes to Philippi and was actually, the people that were upset with his teachings appealed to the local authorities. There were quite a few people that were disagreed with the Apostle Paul. In chapter 16, verse 22, "And the multitude rose up together against them, and the magistrates ripped their clothes and commanded to beat Paul and his associates. And they had laid many stripes upon them, and they cast him into prison, charging the jailer to keep them safely." Again, being a jailer is certainly not like being a centurion, but it was a job of responsibility. And again, if anybody escaped, the axe would fall on the jailer. So it was a high responsibility. And so Paul and his group were considered special prisoners. They were political prisoners and were considered highly dangerous. And so they were placed in the inner prison, verse 24. And if that weren't enough, their feet were put in the stocks, and they were chained. There was no way they were getting out of there. But at midnight, Paul and Silas prayed and sang praises to God, and the prisoners heard them. Suddenly, there was an earthquake so great that the foundations of the prison were shaken, and immediately all the doors were open and everybody's bands were loosened. And the keeper of the prison, awaking out of his sleep, seeing the prison doors open, drew out his sword and would have killed himself, supposing that the prisoners had fled. Well, he didn't want to die on a cross or anything like that. Paul cried out with a loud voice, "Do yourself no harm, for we are all here." Then he called for a light, sprang in, came in trembling down before Paul and Silas. Deep down he knew that these people represented a great God and one that was worthy of worship, and he'd been fighting it. You know, he was a Roman trained, Roman background, and he brought them out, and he says, "I'm going to get to the bottom line." Here he's showing humility. Instead of lording it over those that are captive, he says, "What must I do to be saved?" And they said, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ." Well, it implies more than that. You have to try to live by every word of God as best as one can. "And you shall be saved, and your house." They weren't saved yet, but they could be. But salvation is a lifelong process. Matthew 24:13 says, "He that endures to the end shall be saved." Anyway, they spoke to him the word of the Lord and all that were in his house. And he took them the same hour of the night, washed their stripes, and he was baptized, all and his family, all of his straight away or immediately. And when they brought them into the house, he set food down in front of them and rejoiced, believing in God with all of his house. Now, if in America, if a jailer, somebody said, "Honey, I'm home. We got company. Can you make a meal? I've got five prisoners with me." And she would probably say, "Harry, how many times I got to tell you, don't bring strangers into the house. You know, this is crazy. Things could go bad," and so forth. And in that culture, it was, "Yeah, yavol, okay, I'll do it." And this is not a commercial for male chauvinism. That doesn't exist. But in that society, and it was not perfect, many times oppressive, but one feature, right or wrong, is the head of the house would make a decision such as, "I'm now going to be worship Greek theology," and the whole family would do it. When he said, "These men represent the true God, we're going to worship their God," okay. That's what's decreed. That's what the rest of us will do, even the kids. And when you have that climate, and you have a chain of authority, you have faith. Faith is critical. It seems like the best or the most dynamic examples of faith were people that were under authority. There's another area that we could go to that we don't have time to turn and read. And that's 2 Kings 5 with Naaman, who was a military man, and he was from the nation of Syria. And he had leprosy, and he'd heard that there was a prophet in Israel that could pray to his God, the God of Israel, to get the leprosy to disappear. So he sent an entourage and gifts and people down to the king of Israel and said, I'm coming. I want to meet the representative of your God, and I have leprosy, and I need to be healed." And the king was beside himself. "Why does he ask me? I don't have that kind of power. I don't know anybody that does. Wow, what's going to happen? He's going to get down here with his army. He's going to find out that doesn't exist, and there's no faith around here for something like that, and then he's going to get angry and wage a war on us, a war that we can't win." What a tough break. Who was the guy that got him to think that that leprosy can be healed in this country anyway? That was the reaction of the king. But Naaman came, And then Elijah said, okay, Elijah's servant, Gehazi, says, sir, there's a leader, a military man, a general, that is here for a healing. And he wanted to test Naaman. He said, well, if he wants to be healed of his leprosy, tell him to go 7 times to the Jordan River, dip in the Jordan 7 times, and he'll get rid of his leprosy. So that was the message conveyed to Naaman. And his reaction was, what? Is that how you get rid of leprosy? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. And why did I come all the way down here for this? You know, dip in the Jordan River, which was kind of an anemic river. Sometimes it could be huge. It could be very wide. But on other occasions, it might be as wide as the stage or even less during dry periods. And he was indignant. Naaman was upset. I can't do this. You know, it would be better if I had jumped in one of the rivers back in my own home country. And the amazing thing that turned it around was a little girl between the ages of 6 and 9, somewhere in there, who talked to Naaman's wife and said, she was the one with the original idea that he could come to Israel and get healed. Well, if you've come this far, if you go and do what the prophet says, I'm sure that it will happen. And there was a way to reach Naaman, even though he had this tough veneer, and he was a man of war, and he had to deal with fighting and conquest. He listened again to this little girl who said, you know, it can happen. And so he did go 7 times to the Jordan River. And after the 7th time, he looked down, and miraculously the leprosy was gone. He was ecstatic. He wanted to give all kinds of endless gifts to Elijah or Gehazi or anybody. He was so thankful. And it was interesting that he had a military mind that understood authority. He realized that the one that healed him was a greater authority than the people he served back in Syria. It was extraordinary that these different people could have that kind of faith. In Hebrews chapter 11, we're familiar with what's stated regarding the subject of faith. Hebrews 11, in verse 1, first of all. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And we want faith because we have so many different needs. Maybe it's monetary. Maybe it's health-related. That touches so many of our people. Part of it's a sign of the times. Part of it's demographics of Florida. But whatever it is, there are times when we have trials. There are times when we need help. And sometimes when we pray, I need it, and I need it now. And sometimes it may be just like one that came to Christ. I believe, help my unbelief. There's always a need for us to depend on God, and that's a good thing. And we learn a lot of lessons from that. We walk by faith and not by sight. We'll have a ministerial conference. It will map out a plan, but is it the right one? We hope so. Well, if God will inspire it, well, if we're close enough to God. It's regarding matters of faith, in verse 6 of Hebrews 11, but without faith it is impossible to please God, for he that comes to God, that includes us, must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. We have to know that our God is there for us, not hope that he is. We have to know it. If God, it says in Hebrews 6:18, it is impossible for God to lie. John 10:35, the scripture cannot be broken. Again, Titus 1 and verse 2, it is impossible for God to lie. So when God talks about anything from tithing to healing to whatever it is, he can help. He can make things work. He can invest his Holy Spirit in us, and we can see changes in our lives. We can get the help that we need. This is all made possible by the authority of God that we worship through Christ or his church. And so it is that
God's government represents a great light. We're tapping into that for our particular needs. The practicality of a message like this is that the centurions and other people that were great examples of faith because they understood authority, they set an example for us. Our society is just the opposite. Authority at all levels is being attacked and challenged and disdained. I think like all of you, I would despise the abuse of authority. That is wrong. The resolution to that is in Acts 5:29, we obey. When there's a conflict between the laws of God and the laws of man, if there's a conflict, it says we obey God rather than man. But many times there is not. In other cases in Romans 13, we're to obey the laws of the land. We pay our taxes. We drive the speed limit. We follow the rules. But there are times that we need to have strong faith, strong belief that God is with us, that will help us. We need to ideally have as much conviction as the people that lived under authority on a daily basis. We're under authority, but it's, you know, that we have a wide berth. God doesn't micromanage us. And the government doesn't micromanage us. We have a lot of latitude to make our own decisions. But there are times when we need God's help, and the people that understand it the best oftentimes are the ones that lived under authority that recognize it, that know that it's important to uphold it, to respect the chain of authority, and to gain from the confidence that when a decree is authorized, it's carried out. If God makes a promise, he will fulfill it. May not be as quickly as we would want or expect, but he does that. He does not lie. He does not make that up. So let's strive to have the faith that God wants us to have. We can ask for more of it. We can ask for us to see the government of God, which primarily is in heaven, but we try to implement parts of it on the earth and with each other, which is actions of love toward each other and to live a Christian life. You know, that comes from seeing the greatness of God, that great light, the great authority that God has at his seat in heaven, the government of God that will eventually be on this earth after Christ returns. We have elements of it that we can live under now. Let's be mindful of the example set before us, centurions and other people that appreciate and understood the chain of authority and were able to effectuate great faith in their lives.